Good morning, everyone. Sunday, February 22nd, and here is the latest news. In a few minutes, we'll take you to London for a direct report from our correspondent there, and then Morgan Beatty will be heard from our own nation's capital. First, here is a roundup of late developments from the newsroom in New York. The Dutch High Command in Batavia says at least 8 Japanese bombers and fighter planes were shot down over western Java yesterday, presumably in the area of Surabaya Naval Base. Batavia says only 2 Dutch planes were lost in the aerial battle. And meanwhile, Dutch colonial troops are stabbing at Japanese landing parties on the island of Bali off the eastern tip of Java this morning. Despite an almost constant attack by Dutch and American naval and air forces, the Japs are believed to have established 2 footholds on the small island. But staunch Dutch troops and well-manned Dutch guns still stand between the Japs and the narrow strait separating Bali from the eastern end of Java. There's been no late news of the naval battle in the Bali and Lombok Islands area. The last message from Dutch and American naval and air forces told of some 13 or more Japanese warships and transports seriously damaged or sent to the bottom. It's definite that there'll be more news upcoming. Both Washington and Batavia left no doubt that the battle continues. Japanese bombing planes are extending their raids far behind the British lines in Burma. But the counter-aerial offensive of British and American flyers is believed to be doing heavy damage to Japanese concentration positions and communication lines eastward into Thailand. For 5 days, the Japanese have been battering against British lines along the Bilin River front. But there are still no apparent signs that they've been able to push back these tough British and Indian troops. British commanders are watching Japanese movements for a possible attempt to outflank British entrenchments by landing an invasion force in southwest Burma, on the far side of Rangoon, and attacking from the rear. Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek's troops on the Chinese North Central Front continue their attacks today on Japanese troop concentrations near the Honan-Shantung border. Small bands of Chinese are credited with infiltration of Japanese-held territory and with daring, successful raids on communications lines. Still other Chinese offensives are underway in North Kiangxi province. The British radio says Chinese dispatches claim capture of a large town on the east bank of the Yellow River. Chinese troops are said to have taken the unidentified city despite strong Japanese resistance. In Calcutta, foreign observers believe that Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek's open championship of political freedom for India may soon have some effect on British colonial policy. Yesterday, the Chinese war leader declared that he hopes and believes Britain will give India the political freedom her Gandhis and Pandit Nehrus have been seeking for decades. Chung is in India seeking full military cooperation with his Chinese forces in an effort to stem the Japanese invasion of southern Asia. In a speech at Calcutta, the Chinese strongman expressed his hope that Britain would make political concessions and thereby influence the cooperation of India in what he called a struggle for survival of a free world. Tomorrow is the 24th anniversary of the founding of the Red Army. Foreign observers suspect that the Russians have been saving up a long list of recent gains to be handed out to the world tomorrow as a sort of memorial announcement. This morning's communique from Moscow is still tight-lipped about the geographical details of what is said to be a continued westward advance. Pravda says this morning that the spirit of Hitler's army is broken. The Red Air Force gets considerable detailed attention. One unit is said to have destroyed 180 Nazi trucks, 7 anti-aircraft batteries, 2 radio stations, 180 carts, and 7 armored cars in 5 days. Red Army pilots are credited with silencing 80 Nazi field guns of various caliber, and they are said to have destroyed or silenced 140 mortars and 50 machine gun emplacements. Moscow dispatches relayed by the British radio tell of increasing sabotage in German-occupied France. French workers are credited with planting a time bomb and doing heavy damage to a big armaments works, turning out arms for the Nazi war machine. And at another factory, French saboteurs are said to have held up tank production for 3 days by damaging car transmission lines. Vichy radio reveals that another Frenchman has been executed in Paris. German sentries discovered him in possession of firearms. The president of Uruguay has assured his people that the drastic emergency measures taken to maintain the political status quo of the nation yesterday are only temporary, President Alfredo Baldemir dissolved the Uruguayan Congress, you recall, then assigned 17,000 troops to the job of policing the government. These measures were Baldemir's swift effort to forestall a coup by Senator Luis Herrera, leading foe of inter-American cooperation. Last night, the president assured his people that he neither is an autocrat nor wants to be one. He appealed to Uruguay to set aside its antagonism, its resentments, and material passions. And now for an on-the-spot report of developments in Great Britain, we take you now to London.
This is London. John McVane speaking. British bombers last night bombed the Rhineland and other parts of western Germany. They also laid mines in enemy waters, although it isn't stated whether the mine laying had anything to do with German naval units. Three planes are missing. What a nation can do in war depends on two things: its war equipment and the morale of its people, the way they feel about the fight. The Russians stood up under the German attack, not only because they had the war material to fight back with, but because the Russian people are convinced they have something worth fighting for. The Yugoslavs are still fighting because they too feel they have something worth fighting for. I suppose speakers at home today will be telling you that Washington and his men made a new country, largely out of the belief that that achievement was worth any sacrifice. Perhaps the British loss of that war was partly due to the fact that a large section of British opinion, led by men like Charles James Fox, didn't believe it was worth fighting. It's because how a nation feels is so important that the political reshuffle last week is worth considering again. The feeling of the country today is much stronger and more sure of itself than was the case a few days ago. Mr. Churchill's readiness to yield to public opinion has strengthened his own position and given Britain the impetus of new effort. What we have witnessed in the past few weeks may be the end of an obsolete organization known as the British Empire, but that is no sign of weakness in Britain itself or in the British dominions. The people of this island are expecting a shake-up in the Colonial Office and the India Office. They are looking for administrators and policies that will show an understanding of the progress the world is making. It's being forecast today in London political circles that Sir Archibald Sinclair is to leave his job as Air Minister and that he's to take on a special mission to put the Indian problem on a more satisfactory footing. Many people here feel that fighting to re-establish the rule of a few white men over many colored men isn't worthwhile. To most people of Britain, the colonies are remote and unreal anyway. But I think you may find that if the government adapts its policy to harness the powerful forces of Far Eastern nationalism, the British will fight very hard to free those countries from the Japanese danger. Just as an example, the average Britisher would work and fight to help Chiang Kai-shek and the Chinese people whom he admires. He wouldn't work or fight very hard to impose British rule on any part of China. Some commentators here continually emphasize that Britain needs a flame of belief in the New World to inspire its war effort. John Gordon, editor of Lord Beaverbrook's Sunday Express, says that for Germany, Russia, Japan, and China, this war is a crusade. For the British, he says, the purpose seems to lie in some indefinite hazy dream between bolstering up a dead system of not too scrupulous money-making and political jiggery-pokery and the restoration after the war of trade union privileges. And Gordon says, these may seem very laudable things to many men, but they're not the sort of thing men rush to die for. Then he says, now is the time for a man to arise among us bold enough to say, the old system is dead. From this moment, a new Britain will be born. We shall no longer tolerate the cruelties, unfairnesses, and inequalities of the old one. With the same lavishness as we spent the nation's money on war, we shall spend it on peace reconstruction. No more unemployment, no more starvation, no more privilege except the privilege of work and freedom. And Gordon goes on, no more children with pinched faces, no more slums, an equal chance for every child in his merit and qualities, a minimum adequate standard of living for every citizen, the certainty for all men of comfort throughout working life, and care and decent sustenance in old age. Political thinkers in Britain have been watching closely America's reaction to the war, now that America has become a real part of that war. They're wondering how we will use our potential power, whether we'll have the breadth of vision to use that power for the world's good. An extremely intelligent and thoughtful Frenchman explained what may be a general European point of view toward America at war. He said to me, every nation has its moment in history. France's moment came with the French Revolution, Britain's during the last century with the development of her empire. Today is America's moment. We French are wondering whether she will shirk her responsibilities to herself and to the world, or whether she will use her power to build and organize a better, freer world for Americans and for all the rest of us. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
And here is Morgan Beatty reporting from the newsroom in Washington.
Last week, the fortunes of the United Nations reached their lowest ebb. This week begins the long uphill pull. That's America's view of the war today. As a matter of fact, all of the capitals of the Allied nations and the headquarters of the Axis as well took this view, judging by their actions. On the Axis side, Japan continues to forge ahead in the Far East, and Germany reorganizes Europe for production of military supplies, so that the last possible ounce will be ready for action in the spring. The Axis objective seems to be now to deal the final blow before the strength of America swings the tide. Nothing could have demonstrated this more vividly than the fall of Singapore and the continuing submarine warfare off our own Atlantic coastline. Two more steamers and scores more lives went down in the Caribbean and the Atlantic over the weekend. The American tanker Pan Massachusetts has been sunk with a death toll of 20. 18 survivors are in Jacksonville, Florida. The Norwegian tanker Kongsberg has also been torpedoed. 38 seamen were lost. These events are bringing the war closer to home. We are awakening, and our leadership is moving into a cycle of hard-boiled action. The president promises a realistic report on the world at war tomorrow night at 10 p.m. Eastern Wartime. Go to your radio and take your maps and globes with you. Among other things, he will illustrate how the defense of our coastline is the same problem today it was in Washington's time. He could draw on the experiences of Washington, for example. He could tell how the great revolutionary general refused the demands of coastal cities for protection against enemy raids, and how Washington told them his job was to win a war, and he couldn't do both. There simply does not exist enough manpower and weapons for both purposes. And General Hershey of the draft system gave us a weekend warning. Only a few hours before the anniversary of Washington's birth, 210 years ago, he said we may conscript our manpower for labor as well as military service. He spoke after more than 25 million Americans had registered in one draft call or another. Those 25 million names and records will be surveyed to determine just how a labor conscription on a voluntary basis can be carried out, if it can. And Price Control Administrator Henderson took off the gloves, too. He told farmers, industry, and labor alike that we face a 12% cut in the American standard of living, even if wages and prices stay right where they are. And he warned us that we face dangerous inflation if farmers and labor demand higher prices and higher wages, and if industry demands greater profits. But all the week's news was not Allied gloom and ebbing fortune. The signs of the flood tide could be seen in the far distance. Assistant Secretary of War Patterson made a report. He reported to the Senate Appropriations Committee. His report was not revealed, but senators said afterwards he had amazed them with production figures. They said the government was really whipping the production bottleneck with the help of workers. Workers who tomorrow will give up the legal Washington birthday holiday, and workers who last week shoved steel production to the highest level in our history. Meanwhile, MacArthur's men still hold out in Bataan Peninsula on Washington's birthday, and American sea and land forces deliver costly blows to the advancing Japanese. They're exhibiting the same spirit that animated Washington when he accepted the command of the Revolutionary Army from Congress. On that day, he told the lawmakers that he would answer the call to duty, but, and I quote George Washington, "I beg it will be remembered that I this day declare with the utmost sincerity, I do not think myself equal to the command I am honored with." Ladies and gentlemen, he meant what he said. The fact is, his military experience hardly justified his appointment, but he had something else. He had dignity of citizenship, and above all, faith. Faith in a nation as yet unborn. That's all for now.
And that's the news up to this moment. You have heard John McVane in London, Morgan Beatty in Washington, and bulletins from our newsroom in New York. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.